Who are you?
My name's Buzz.
And Buzz, who do you have with you?
I have the rest of my Melvins with me. This is Dale.
I'm Dale.
And this is Dave over here.
Hi.
Now tonight,
David Scott Stone.
Now tonight, what are you guys functioning as?
We're playing with the legendary Jello Biafra.
So is your name Buzz in the Jelvins? What is your name in the Jelvins? What are the name of the Jelvins?
I like to be called Buzz, but you can call me whatever you like.
I thought there were special names for the Jelvins.
I don't remember. That was Jello's thing.
Oh, those names. I can't remember what mine was.
We haven't seen the Jello hasn't given us any copies of the record yet, so we don't know what he put on there.
You have no idea what your name is in the Jelvins.
I have not been given my name yet.
So what is your experience with Jello? How do you know Jello Biafra?
I've met Jello Biafra through Buzz and Dale.
Now, how did Buzz and Dale meet Jello Biafra?
Well, Jello never liked us until relatively recently.
How did you know this?
Because there's no one that's more prominent at shows in San Francisco than Jello Biafra, and we played all the time, and he never came to see us. So it was clearly obvious he had no interest in us, especially when I saw the low-key bands that he was generally involved with.
Now, how do you know he didn't go to your shows? I mean, you've lived in San Francisco for a long time, right?
Oh, he makes it known that he is at your show by coming up and...
You miss him. You can't miss Jello if he's in the room. And we were playing shows to 50 people. You know,
how did you know he didn't like you?
Because we were the only band he didn't ask for free merchandise from.
Yeah. He hit my band up for free merchandise a long time ago. Yeah.
And so when you joined the Melvins and he wasn't asking for stuff, you knew something was astray, something was gone wrong.
I knew I'd step down that path.
But then what happened? How did it all come together?
We were brought together by the mutual love of Alice Cooper.
Now, why is that?
Because Alice Cooper is a lovable guy.
What particular song bounded you guys together?
It was a song called Halo of Flies.
And actually, we have the man here himself. Jello. Jello. No, Jello, just quickly here, because I know you guys got to go on and all, but what are the names of these guys? Who are these guys?
Oh, let's see. That's the old bass player from Molly Hatchet.
No, on the record.
No, on the record. They don't even know their names.
Oh, let me see if I can remember him. I was Osama McDonald. That would make him JonBenet Malone.
Who's him?
Buzz. Okay. And Dale was, which one was which now? I can't remember. I think Saddam Disney was the bass player, which would make... How can I space on these names? I got too much on my mind right now.
Just about to go on stage. But your bandmates, what do you address them on stage? You don't call them the names? Like, don't the fans demand the names, Jello?
Well, we make up different names on different nights.
And it's all through Halo of Flies. This has all come together. So why did you not like the Melvins before, Jello?
They didn't sound enough like Halo of Flies.
But why did it take so long? Like, I was defending you against the Melvins. I was defending you against the Melvins. Well, you said that Jello never came to any of your shows.
I was strictly stating the facts. That's it. I saw them.
So why did it take so long?
I did see some of their shows, though. And it just...
We were opening for a band that you came to see.
Who am I to deny the obvious? But no, it's just something clicked. I was getting into them that night. It was just a really massive, powerful rockin' show and a little less...
No, I remember you came backstage after a show that I was playing with them.
What band?
When I was playing guitar with the Melvins in 2001, and you came back looking for beer, and you said, "Oh, pretty good show. I finally got it."
By George, I think I got it.
And it was Alice Cooper.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is interesting. Like, I heard that Fat Mike from Fat Records, Jello, signed Propaganda after he heard them do a Cheap Trick song.
I wouldn't know anything about that. I'd wonder which one they would do, too.
Surrender. Propaganda did Surrender. So is that the difference between Fat Records and Alternative Tentacles? You know, Alice Cooper versus Cheap Trick?
Well, we don't surrender. That's why Fat Records makes all the money.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, Fat Mike doesn't come to our shows either.
Who does come to your shows? Come on, you've been going for years. There must have been some people that go to your shows.
Apparently so, but none of these famous punk rockers do.
One thing I wanted to ask you guys about, just quickly here, I don't know if you guys noticed this, and I did try to point this out to Jello Biafra, and I'm not sure if you noticed it, but did you guys notice the similarity? And this is the, look at that. Look at this CD here. Nico Case.
Nico Case.
Her new Nico Case record. Look at the cover.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, yeah, well, actually, I saw this and didn't tell Jello, and then we ripped it off.
It's like very the same, isn't it?
It is. Like, well, you know, if you're into something that's not as cool as ours, then...
They didn't have enough money for the colors, though,
does it?
And that's on Epitaph, Jello. Have you seen the similarities between... Epitaph,
never heard of it.
Nico Case and the Jelvins almost together.
Oh, I hadn't seen this either. I'll have to go find my good buddy East Bay Ray to find the lawyers to try and shake her down for a good $500,000 for
ripping off the stuff we ripped off.
Who did you rip off?
Well, this is obviously we didn't draw this picture. It came from somewhere else. Plagiarism is the most sincere form of television. Remember that.
And tonight, you guys are going to be doing a song about a cock detector lie ring. What is this thing? This cock detector thing. Lie detector.
I think you're thinking of a plethysmograph, which is used at least in the Arizona prison system and maybe others, where they put it around a sex offender's dick and show them pictures like Clockwork Orange. And if the dick starts to pulsate or expand, they don't get their parole.
When working with Jello Biafra, Buzz...
I didn't get my parole.
How about the lyrics? How about the politics? Are you guys down with Jello, with everything that's going on? Do you under? Because you don't even know your names on the record. Do you know what the record is about at all?
I've heard it.
Yeah, I know all the lyrics.
Now, what particular songs are you guys interested in? What have become the crowd favorites, do you think, like you guys playing last night?
Shows we've done so far since it's come out?
Hard to say.
I don't know. Probably the Dead Kennedy songs.
And you spread those ones out.
Yeah, we sprinkle them throughout the set. It makes sense. But, you know, when you work with somebody like Jello, who's known for his lyrics, I'm not one to stand in the way of that sort of thing. It's like he writes the lyrics, he sings, so we just let him do his job. That's fine. I was sure that whatever he came up with would be fine.
When you guys took on the job as the Jelvins, did you realize that you had a lot to live up to, Dale?
We did. We did.
Actually, I realized that I had a lot to live down.
Did you look towards other groups for inspiration? Because Jello has worked with, like, Ministry, DOA, No Means No. Did you have any prototype?
We looked to all those bands for inspiration.
We'd seen those bands before. As far as inspiration.
What do you think, Jello, that the Melvins have brought you that, say, Napalm Death or Ministry haven't?
Oh, I would say raw power and,
Heartburn?
Heartburn, yeah. A lot of heartburn, definitely.
I think in New Age, they call it the oneness of everything.
Yeah. Way to weasel out of it.
No. And just winding up here, just quickly, because I know you guys got to go on stage here. I wanted to just present Jello with a little gift here. And maybe you guys in the Jelvins can comment on this. Jello, this is for you. It's a Canadian gift of Canadian rocker. Canadian heavy metal legend Thor. What can you tell the people about Thor, and are you a Thor fan, Jello?
Well, I found the album this album in a 50 cent bin in San Francisco the week it came out, and thought, well, this is so ridiculous, I have to take it home. And then somebody I knew who used to manage the Young Canadians said he went to high school with him in Toronto, and that he used to do his workouts and lifting in the middle of the football field so everybody could watch. But I guess he lives in the Vancouver area now. My friend Annie Kidd has been an on again off again guitarist with him, and we haven't actually met, but obviously
not much about Thor. I can't believe it.
I know. Well, somebody has me on Thor's promo list, so I keep getting the new albums too.
This is a Thor Keep the Dogs Away shirt, and you have actually met him before, because believe it or not, Jelvins, Thor actually played with Jello. This was back east. On the marquee, it said Jello Biafra, Thor, and Ron Jeremy.
Oh, yeah. Well, I personally am really into female weightlifting, so.
The Three Amigos.
That might have been in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and we were on different nights, but they put us all on the marquee.
Yeah, it is amazing, isn't it? Jello Biafra, Ron, Jeremy, and Thor all together, one night only.
Although it's not as cool as the ad in Spokane for my spoken word show that was a two-part ad. I was in one half and Dolly Parton was in the other. That's almost as cool as the poster with me and Richie Blackmore advertised on it in Holland.
Well, thanks so much, Jelvins. Perhaps maybe we can reconvene later, Jello, perhaps, maybe?
Well, as my geometry teacher who spoke in tongues once said, maybe so. Probably not. Oh, well.
Okay, Jelvins, keep on rocking in the free world and doot-doot-a-loot-doo.
Doot-doot.
Who are you?
I'm the lost lead singer and tuba player for Venom.
You are Jello? Bye.
Keep going.
Af.
Jello Biafra. Okay, let's keep.
You are Jello Biafra. And Jello, we're here in Seattle. You've just played with the Melvins, but a couple weeks ago, or maybe months ago, you were in Vancouver encoring with Ministry. What was that all about?
Oh, I just hopped on the Ministry bus because we wanted to do a little bit of the Lard songs and, thought I'd hop on. And I hadn't been to Vancouver in a while, and I hadn't sung anything in Vancouver, I guess, since I did Chew with No Means No ages ago. So I thought it might be fun.
And last night I saw you play with the Jelvins.
That's what some people are calling it. It's me and the Melvins plus Adam Jones from Tool is another guitar player. So it's a good wall of sound showing people how it's done.
And I haven't seen you perform in a long time, Jello, and just seeing you is amazing. Where did you come up with all the neat facial gestures and kind of miming and stuff? It's incredible. Was it inspired by the Screamers? Because what you were doing there, has that progressed since the Dead Kennedys? Is there any new stuff you were throwing in there?
Well, I don't plan that stuff. It just happens. And I could probably do it a lot better if I actually rehearsed in front of the mirror as much as the singer for the Makers does. And that's not a diss on Michael. He's a good friend of mine. And he's a very, very good performer in his own way. And a lot of those, maybe if there was any big influence on the facial expressions, it predates the Screamers and goes back to a weekly TV show by a very, very good comedian by the name of Red Skelton. I think that was the secret influence I didn't realize for years. You know, I really like performers who really work and put out and add something demented. And I thought, wait a minute, there's not just bits of Iggy sprinkled in all this. After all, I'm not very athletically coordinated, but you cross Iggy and Red Skelton only with somebody who can't do either very well, then it better be funny. So I guess that's what I do.
The yuppie SUV gestures were incredible. Like, were you like mimicking us being on a cell phone there and driving at the same time?
And running over a bunch of kids.
Could you demonstrate that this quickly for the camera, Jello? This quickly?
Remember it. Let me see. Just,
the name of the song is?
Yuppie Cadillac. You know, like the modern grandpa car, the gas guzzler equivalent of the old giant sedan, is the SUV. And most people who buy them specifically because they're expensive and eat a lot of gas. And aren't we cool that we're sending American troops to go get blown up in Iraq just so we can drive gigantic cars that are often too large to even fit down a European street?
And some of your gestures were, wasn't it like, what was that?
Oh, for no, you do them first. I want to see you try to recreate them.
Well, it was something like, something like that. I mean, I can come nowhere close, Jello.
God damn. Well, I need room to move here for this. I think that the male driver was the first verse, so he was more. And then the second verse was more like the, what they call the soccer mom, or the, or what Frank Zappa calls the yuppie parents and their artifact children, you know, just driving like, they're great big for your Tilly vehicle, can't control talking on the phone, just ran over some kids, oh well, I guess that was it.
That's amazing. All while singing, playing live on stage with the Jelvins in Seattle. That was amazing. And I saw that way from the back. Like, mine really translates to the back of the crowd.
Oh, that's interesting. Because somebody early on in the...
I was afraid to get in the pit because people were going pretty crazy. There was that Mohawk guy that was getting slid right into. He was having a good time now, wasn't he?
Yeah, they were going to throw him out, and I told the guy to let him go. So he didn't get on stage again, but he got to stay.
Speaking of getting thrown out and stuff, Jello Biafra, did you really once interview Nina Hartley nude at the Republican convention?
Yes. She wasn't at the convention site itself. She was in an adult bookstore nearby, and she was indeed doing an in-store nude. and probably reveling in the disarming reactions she got from everybody who walked in, including me. And she told me that from her sex worker friends network, she'd gotten the word that they had flown in 350 very high-priced $1,500 American a night call girls to service the right-wing family values Nazis at the 2000 Republican convention, making me think, my God, how many did they have to bring into New York City in 2004 just to service Bill O'Reilly and Schwarzenegger alone?
And she was ready to name names, wasn't she? Or did she name names? Or you weren't allowed to get those names?
She didn't name names. I think, it might not have even been names who were partaking. It might have just been the respectable businessman from the country club in Iowa who got away from the wife for a week to do important business to help install a cowboy in the White House. But in the meantime, getting it on with a lot of cowgirls. She might wonder how he got all the cigarette butt burns on his ass when he came home. I just sat in an ashtray while I was talking to James Baker. You know how these things are, honey.
Where can we see this video, Jello? You interviewing a nude Nina Hartley.
Some of it, I think, went out on Free Speech TV, and the raw footage I may have somewhere. One of the Free Speech TV people does. I've never had time to get all that stuff edited down. I can only edit down and regurgitate my past so much without going nuts, because then I can't get anything done for the future.
Jello Biafra, I was thinking about cool world leaders. I don't know what you think about Lenin.
I don't have real encyclopedic knowledge of Lenin, although
I recently learned that he could play the theremin, that he was really into the theremin. What do you think about that? Vladimir Lenin learning the theremin.
Well, I think he would have been better off concentrating on the theremin than what happened with the Soviet Union. I mean, there are some good ideas in communism, but just like capitalism done in North America and the industrialized world, you take a few good things and then add some greed and some lust for power, and it can turn into something very oppressive. I mean, we don't, you know, was it communism over there? Was it just a plain old military dictatorship and fascism?
How does
here, is it capitalism or is it feudalism?
How does Lenin compare to Jimmy Carter? Because is it true, Jello, you were saying that Jimmy Carter didn't want major labels to sign punk bands, that maybe Jimmy Carter wasn't that cool, that he actually talked to the record labels not to sign punk bands?
My vague memory of that is somebody mentioned it to me around 1980 or 79 when Carter was still president, claiming they had either gotten that information from Robert Fripp or read it in an interview with Robert Fripp. But I've never had a chance to ask Fripp if that was even true. I haven't met the man.
In this most recent American election, people are looking at John Edwards going, man, he's a good guy. But I heard you say something about how he's good at suing people. John Edwards is good at suing people. Isn't he a nice, clean-cut gentleman?
Well, he knew how to package himself as a clean-cut gentleman, but I've said it once, I'll say it again. We have a one-party state masquerading as a two-party state, and you can call them the Republicrats or the corporate party or whatever you want, but just as like you have actors pretending to be president, like Ronald Reagan or where George Bush the First was the real president instead of Ronald McRagan, and then King George the Second, now the idiot son, the court jester with the cowboy hat, he's not the real president. Cheney's calling the shots. And the other guy just reads his cue cards, and when he doesn't have his cue cards in his hands, it's just like when Reagan claimed that air pollution was caused by plants and trees. You leave Bush alone at a press conference, and what does he do but say things like, it's an honor to shake hands with someone who had their hand cut off by Saddam Hussein. I mean, how, this guy's the president?
Is there any future for John Edwards at all?
I hope not. I mean, he can just count his money from now on and get the hell out of our lives. He cared so much about really making a difference, he didn't even run to keep his Senate seat at the same time he was running for president and settled for vice president, and that seat went to a Republican instead of a Democrat. But here he was in the vice presidential debate, and he could have kicked Cheney's ass. Even the straight corporate media was calling Cheney the Prince of Darkness and all, and wondering if Bush was going to take him off the ticket, because because people hated him so much. Cheney cleaned his clock. I mean, Edwards just kept pulling down his pants, waiting for Cheney to paddle him like an obedient little schoolboy. Hi, I'm John Edwards, and I have this cute little accent, just like the Andy Griffith Show, and I kind of look like Al Gore with Austin Powers' teeth, like my hair, and I made so much money suing people, I think I should be president. And Cheney just sat there and tore him to pieces, and by the end of that debate, Cheney was rehabilitated.
You think that—
Not just with the Fox News crew, but with the wannabe Fox News crew. And Edwards let it happen. What I'm getting at is, I guess if we have actors portraying the president, we have to have actors portray the loser in order to keep the illusion of election and freedom of choice going.
You think that—
How else do you explain people like John Kerry, John Edwards, Al Gore, Michael Dukakis, and Walter Mondale going so far out of their way to make perfectly good points of view look so bad?
Do you think that that was George Bush during the debates? Because, you know, they said he had that weird thing on his back, that he might have been an imposter, might have been a pacemaker or something like that. Was it actually George Bush? Is George Bush actually alive?
I don't think his brain is. I mean, there's a little robot. I mean, maybe Pixar made him. I don't know. I think he's more like, you know, a tough guy actor on the level of Bruce Willis or Schwarzenegger, who knows how to appear tough and appear presidential. Like it or not, he's very telegenic. And even when he was, you know, carrying on like a carnival barker or a 1890s snake oil salesman in his debate with Kerry, where he looked like he needed an ankle chain around him to keep him from mauling his own audience. You know, we're going to fight terror. We're going to fight terror. Well, what about the economy? We're going to fight terror. We're going to fight terror. And that gets spun around instead of saying Bush is really fucking stupid. And it's obvious now. They say, oh, he stayed on message, therefore he won. Kerry tried to get too intellectual for America or something. And oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, Jello, speaking of intellectual and Rolling Stone magazine, you contributed to Rolling Stone magazine, contributed to the top 500 records of all time. And I'm fascinated to know, what were some of the records that you contributed or that you nominated for the best 500 records of all time? Or what did you do for Rolling Stone?
I'm amazed they asked me about that. I mean, I also got a form letter from Yoko Ono asking me to write a reflection of John Lennon for a book she's compiling. So be interesting to see if they print that one.
You should actually mentioned the Vancouver connection to that, because the Pointed Sticks played on the Vancouver show the night John Lennon was shot.
Well, I don't think there would have been room for that. There wasn't even room for speculating, especially knowing Yoko was going to read it. You know, what would Charles Manson blame his crimes on if he only had Elvis to work with instead of the White Album?
For Rolling Stone, do you remember any of the top 500 that you nominated?
Me tender and dripping blood in Sharon Tate's house. I mean, who knows what would have happened? Manson with an Elvis do?
The top 500 records, Jello. I was still curious about this. Like, which ones did you nominate?
Well, what I was getting to is they sent a list of nominees, very few of which I thought deserved to be in the top 500 songs. It wasn't records, it was songs of all time. So I mostly did write-ins, knowing they probably wouldn't get in, but I had to work with my conscience here. I mean, the only non-major label punk rock song in the list was TV Party by Black Flag. No Minor Threat. No Dead Kennedys, none of that. No other Black Flag, anything. No Bad Brains. So I can't remember them in order. They had 50 nominees, and I think number one was Talk Talk by the Music Machine for me. Number two, Down on the Street by the Stooges. Number three, Rock and Roll McDonald's by Wesley Willis. I think Cop Killer by Body Count was in the top five or ten. And I ended it with Fuck the Police by NWA, and then Go Fuck You by Hank Williams III, partly a little statement to the owners of Rolling Stone, too.
Jello, what about the song Wigwam Blues? It's been described by you as the La Brea Tar Pits of music. What is Wigwam Blues? I think it's something to do with the Lomax.
I can't remember this at all. What are you talking about?
Didn't you visit where they do the American music, you know, where they study all those 78s, Alan Lomax? Didn't you, like, visit there and you signed in their guest book and you said that you loved the Wigwam Blues because it was the La Brea Tar Pits of music?
I have no memory of doing that. I do remember going to the Lomax archives because my friend Don Fleming, the one who used to be in Gumball and Velvet Monkeys and all, he works there now and invited me into the inner sanctum where you could look down these long hallways hallways off into space and see row upon row of master tapes, films shot by Mr. Lomax from maybe the 1920s or even the 10s on up, photographs. He was an excellent photographer, just a bottomless pit of amazing history. It's a shame there weren't 100 more Alan Lomaxes, but even now, it was, hey, there were at least half a dozen people all these years later still trying to catalog and figure out everything that guy was able to record. He recorded blues, field hollers right in the fields where the workers were working. He recorded people in other countries as well. And I flipped one photo in the book and they said, oh yeah, this is a 90-year-old man that Alan interviewed in the 20s about his life as a slave. I mean, that's the kind of history that you don't get unless somebody is willing to go out and get that kind of stuff and somehow has a way of preserving it all.
Jello, is there anything close to Wesley Willis? Is Zoller X the closest thing to Wesley Willis? What can you say about Zoller X? Is there anything close to Wesley Willis? Is Zoller X taking up the slack?
Well, I think that's like comparing apples and rocket fuel or something. I don't think there's any real direct comparison. Zoller X is a completely different beast entirely. Wesley Willis, there was only one, and there will only be one, and we get demos all the time saying, hey, I'm as strange as Wesley Willis, but of course it's people who are just like indie rock geeks who whose friends in the dorm think they're slightly weird and everything, and it went to their head. But Zoller X was something very different. It was a pre-punk glam band from the early 70s who lasted to about 1980. And the difference between them and the New York Dolls or Bowie or Jabriath, who they knew, was they wore spacesuits and sometimes helmets, pointed ears.
What did they wear on stage? Like, what were their stage props? There are some pictures I've seen them, like, on stage, looked like their drums looked pretty cool. Or they had other props as well. Did they just wear the space? Like, what was their actual stage setup like?
Well, the more they could get away with, the more they did. They apparently did the entire Starwood in L.A. Into the inside of a spaceship for one show. That was what they were into. They wore the spacesuits all the time. They sometimes, and they claimed they were from another planet all the time. And sometimes there's one rumor that one of them got clocked by Ron Ashton at a party because he wouldn't stop talking in his own space alien language. Don't know.
And you're recognizing the genius of Zoller X now, Jello Biafra. But long ago, is it true there was some Monkees connection? They were going to be the next Monkees. They were going to do the next Elvis comeback.
Well, that's a Nardwarish exaggeration, to put it mildly. Basically, there was some producer who wanted to try and make a Monkees-ish TV show based around them, and I think it lasted one meeting with a Hollywood executive producer, and that was it. But Zoller was a fascinating story on par with the Monks. You know, there ought to be a book, there ought to be a movie, but lo and behold, through a writer person I knew, we found out he knew where the guy who had the master tapes was.
So they never actually released a 7-inch at their time.
They apparently did of about 15 copies. You know, this is before punk brought the whole DIY independent music thing back. So they pressed 15 copies and gave them to major label executives and club bookers, hoping for the big break, which was how the game you had to play at that point. And that's why a lot of the 70s stuff was so boring, was because you had to play on the major by the major label's rules. But I saw a picture of Zoller X and Lenny Kaye's old magazine Rock Scene when I was in high school. I found a Rock Scene on a sidewalk and looked at it, and there was a picture of Zoller X with their suits, and they even had the mics like this, the first people ever to use one of those. I'm not sure it worked, but the aesthetic was nice. And
like Dale uses in the Gelfins. Yeah.
And I thought, like, well, this is the most ridiculous band I think I've ever seen, and remembered it for that, although the review did say they sound kind of like Pink Floyd crossed with Black Sabbath. So then years later, what do I find in the bargain bin of Aquarius Records in San Francisco but this little mysterious clear vinyl disc that was a self-bootleg of Zoller X after they broke up. and I was blown through the wall. I couldn't believe how good the music was. I never would have guessed. It was like the missing link between Chrome and the Stooges with some cheap trick pop hooks and vocals thrown in. So, you know, I bought the rest of the copies and traded them to my record friends overseas, and people were blown away by it. And I thought, wouldn't this be cool to try and unearth this sometime? Because it was basic, not very good sound quality on the bootleg either. And we actually got the real tapes. So found out there was way, way, way more there, and found Weigar Weigarist, the guitar player, and he's found a couple of the others now, and they're even starting to play again. So,
what did the punks think of them? Like, were they on any punk bills, and what did the LA punks think of them, or were they kind of broken up by that time?
I don't remember them ever even being advertised at the Mabuhay or anything, but they obviously played there, because there was even a picture of them on the, in the dressing room wall at the Mabuhay in San Francisco. And I don't think they related to punk per se. I think the singer thought it was all beneath them and everything, which is the worst attitude you can take from up and coming belligerent punk pioneers who want to, you know, there wasn't any old school per se at the time, thank God, but we were sure having fun blowing up some other schools.
Was it hard?
The Hotel California.
Was it hard, Jello Biafra, to negotiate the re-release of Zolar X? Like, what were these guys like now dealing with? I think some of them are dead, aren't they? Like, did they want lots of royalties? Did they not want their music to come out?
No, it was actually, the biggest problem was me, because I have so many other things going on and tour schedules. I kept starting to get it narrowed down. Then I'd have to go on the road, and then Weigar would call, "What's going on? I haven't heard from you." And this went on for a year and a half, and I can't blame him for being a little annoyed at times, but he was sure happy when it came out. And one of them is in prison now for something I'm sure he regrets doing, and will eventually get out. And I guess he finally got a copy of the album and was very pleased with how it came out. So just happy to see this come out after all these years. I mean, it's also really brought home to me, you know, how what an emotional thing it is for people sometimes to put this much work and talent into something they knew was really special, and then it never came out, and then finally it does, and instead of turning into some venom-spitting East Bay Ray type about the whole thing, they're just very, very thankful and grateful and happy it finally worked.
Jello Biafra, winding up here, IRS Records, A&M, I've always been confused by this. You were released on faulty product, the Dead Kennedys were. What was your connection to IRS and A&M, and were you maybe going to end up on a major label in the very beginning there? Or were you on one? Did you sign anything?
We never signed with a major label. IRS was the pseudo-independent arm of A&M that was owned and operated by Miles Copeland, who managed the Police and some of the other people.
Ex-CIA guy, right?
No, his father was number three at the CIA through several presidents. That's why the Police got to play in Pinochet's Chile and all these other countries that other bands couldn't get into. And Copeland was not exactly the most honest guy in the world and had a real scary reputation, but East Bay Ray kind of rammed us into IRS, and then but A&M distributed IRS, and they refused to distribute Dead Kennedys because Jerry Moss, the M in A&M, was a yachting buddy of Ted Kennedy and just couldn't do that. So the non-major label distribution arm of IRS was started, called Faulty Products, which proved to be a very appropriate name for the thing. As soon as they owed a lot of us money, Miles folded the company. And luckily, people like DOA and the Farts and TSOL and 7 Seconds didn't come suing us, because they were manufacturing, distributing alternative tentacles at the time, too. And what I learned from that was, don't ever do an M&D deal with anybody again. Do it all yourself, even if it means starting a lot smaller. And then there were some, it's weird, at the beginning, well, after Fresh Fruit did well, British major labels were beating down our door, while the American branches of same major labels wanted nothing to do with this, although there was an occasional little feeler like, we'll give you all the artistic control you want if you just change your name. And then Ray was trying to push me into signing with Polydor in Europe, and I made up my mind that, you know, you never threaten to quit a band unless you mean it or it has no meaning, and you damn well better not do it unless you mean it. And my feeling was, if those guys went and signed with Polydor, I was going to quit on the spot. And then, I did let it let the word go back over to a British agent. Well, you know, the next single's going to be called Too Drunk to Fuck. So see what Polydor thinks of that. And we never heard from Polydor again. I was greatly relieved, but then 12 years later, long after the band broke up, East Bay Ray called me out of the blue in Texas in the studio where I was working on the Mojo Nixon album and yelled at me for an hour about how I'd wrecked his life because we didn't sign with Polydor 12 years before.
Jello Biafra, we're almost out of tape. Doot doot a loot doo.